You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you may have noticed more vegan-friendly options popping up at your local grocery store. Veganism is becoming a way of life for more and more people, and we'll hear from the writer of a field manual for vegan life about surviving the military as a vegan and about navigating holiday meals. Now, new data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows the American infant mortality rate has not declined in a significant way since 2011. The U.S. has lagged behind most developed countries, with nearly 6 out of every 1,000 infants born in 2016 dying before their first birthday. Ashley Mutzek is the executive director of March of Dimes Wisconsin, a group that advocates for the health of mothers and babies. Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what jumped out to you from this CDC report, as somebody who works on these issues of premature births here in Wisconsin?
Well, I know working with March of Dimes, we have our birth prematurity report card that comes out every year. And for the third year in a row, more U.S. babies have been born just premature and just too soon, which is about 9.93% nationwide for prematurity rate. And one of those largest complications and largest, like about a third of the babies that are born too soon die from infant mortality. And so it's a direct correlation to what we do every single day and what I see. And just knowing that premature birth and its complications are the largest contributors to infant death during their first year in the U.S. is a huge leading cause for babies actually nationwide that are children under 5 as well. So the direct correlation between the CDC report and us is just, it's mind-blowing to know that that many babies are dying every year. Here in Wisconsin, 417 of those babies don't get to go home, and they don't get to celebrate their first birthday, which hits home for a lot of our families that we work with and hits home for a lot of the people that, you know, sponsor and work with us on a daily basis.
And here in Wisconsin, as around the nation, there are, as I understand it, racial and economic disparities in who's affected by premature birth. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So there are, you know, there's four main causes of infant mortality. And so you go back to whether it's prematurity, birth defects, sudden explained infant death, which is referred to as SIDS, and then maternal complications. And in all of those four different causes, you really look and you see the racial disparities that exist on infant mortality in women, whether a baby's born premature and lives, or a baby's born premature has birth defects, or a baby's born premature and dies. And so a lot of those are just chronic inequities that equal to unequal access to quality health care. It has a huge negative impact on their premature birth rates. Here in Wisconsin, women of color actually have 50% more likely to deliver a preterm baby. And those babies that are born face up to, like, I think it's 130% higher infant death rate compared to children of a white woman, which is just devastating. It's something that we're not doing. What are we doing here that we could do better? The United States is looked at, and we have, like, some of the worst maternity care rates, and we, across the whole U.S., it's not just here in Madison or Wisconsin. Particularly, this happens in a lot of the communities that have higher poverty rates. And, you know, across the nation, we have over 10 million women that don't have the right access to health. Health insurance and coverage for health care is a huge critical piece that all women during their reproductive years need to be able to have. Because when you take care of mom and you have healthy mom, it's going to equal the strong babies that we're hoping for and the success stories and less infant death rates.
Talking to Ashley Mutzek, executive director of the Wisconsin chapter of the March of Dimes, looking at new national numbers from the CDC on infant mortality rates around the country. We're talking about premature birth, a big part of that story of infant mortality, and maybe what could be done to prevent premature birth. And let's get to that, Ashley. I think when I think about premature birth, I almost think it's like something that randomly happens. It's going to happen to some people. It's not going to happen to others. But what I'm hearing you say is, no, there are interventions we can do to make it so it happens less often. So what kind of things can we do?
Absolutely. So You know, some of the things that the March of Dimes does, we do improve health of babies and moms and babies, and preventing birth defects, prematurity, infant mortality. We are a research organization, and we have 5 prematurity research centers around the stateside. They're group-based science, and we invest in that research to be able to get some proven programs that come out of what we work on to help just reduce prematurity. A woman goes into labor, and there is no reason why. There is no scientific reason why and what this happens, why this happens. So we are doing our best due diligence to be able to come up with those reasons, to be able to put programs in place that reduce prematurity, infant mortality, and birth defects. And some of those that we are investing in local programs and those innovative solutions that we've come up with, one of the largest ones that we've been sharing a lot with recently is our group prenatal care. And what that is it took off a couple of years ago in our state, and it has just continually expanded and become like an amazing piece that women can participate in. Instead of going and getting an individual checkup with your one-on-one doctor, it's actually a group center. You sit in a group with women around the same gestation age as you, and you get to learn from each other. There's doctors, there's nurse practitioners, there's other people in the room, and you're getting more one-on-one time with your doctor. You're being able to get the support, the care, a healthy snack, being able to relieve some of that stress. Daycare is provided. If you are unable to commute to them, we get vouchers, and there's just so much put into this. And UW is actually doing it amazingly here in Madison. They're actually going to be launching their 5th site of Centering Pregnancy, and we've been hand-in-hand working with them and being able to provide some funding to get those groups up and going. A woman that participates in this has an 80% chance, less chance of having a preterm baby, no matter what the age or race is. So, again, one of those proven pieces that we're working on is that. Other things that is huge, part of what we're trying to push is we have a smoking cessation. We have a NICU family support. Our program in Milwaukee is to die for. It's amazing. They are able to give so much more support to those families that are actually in the NICU, spending that time in there with their preterm babies.
And NICU, I should say, neonatal intensive care unit. Is that right?
Yes. they give that support to those families while they're in there. It's a traumatic to have your baby in the NICU, and whether it's yours or your family's, your cousin, your mom, your sister, whoever it is related to you, it's a huge toll on them. Some babies have to get transported to a NICU, and the closest one could be a couple hundred miles away. You're traveling back and forth to see your baby in the hospital in an isolette that you can't do much for. So our person in Milwaukee, her name is Angie, she literally relates. And she will give the comfort and support and those things with all of those families there, which is a huge piece that we'd love to be able to get going other places in the state.
Now, reading your state-by-state report, it looks like Milwaukee County in particular in Wisconsin, we have some of the biggest racial disparities, some of the biggest concerns about premature births. You mentioned that neonatal intensive care unit program you've got going in Milwaukee. Are you putting a lot of other efforts like that, the group pregnancy cohort, that kind of thing in the Milwaukee area?
Yeah, we are. We're actually meeting with a couple of different places to work on that, as well as some of our training institutes for our healthcare providers. So both of those programs are 2 big pushes that we have on our books for 2019, and look forward to continuing pushing that, especially that Centering Pregnancy.
So when would these annual reports come out, whether it's from the CDC or from you at the March of Dimes, what are you looking for where you see, okay, we're really moving the needle, we're making a difference when it comes to premature births?
I think it kind of goes back to, like, what is triggering it, right? So what are those pieces that we can actually help push forward in a positive manner? So, like, what's behind that report card? What's behind that C? How does it C come up, or the report that the CDC goes, or our report cards with March of Dimes? There's a ton of different factors that are triggered, from whether it's by having multiple births, biological, environmental factors, multiple gestations. But some of the factors that we focus on in Wisconsin particularly are the maternal age. Preterm birth rates are highest for women ages 40 and older. And then smoking. So 18.9% of women of childbearing age smoke. And that's one of the higher states that do that. And it's like, this is an important piece. Like, this is a detriment to your baby, and people continue to smoke. So how do we do that? We go through our smoking cessation program, and we try to make sure that people are taking care of themselves before those babies. Multiple births is another one, which when there's a singleton, you only have one baby, your premature rate is actually only at like a 7.6, but once you start having twins and triplets, whether it's through IVF or any other piece of being able to get pregnant, or if you're just going to have twins, it actually jumps up to 58.4%, which is a huge jump. And the stress that two babies have on the mom is a big piece. So making sure that people that are going through IVF and going through a really difficult time personally, we're trying to help them make sure that they're taking care of their body as well, because that's a huge piece of the puzzle when we look at that.
We'll leave it there for now. Ashley, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
No problem. Thank you for having me in.
That was Ashley Mutzik, Executive Director of March of Dimes Wisconsin, with us to talk about the issue of premature births in Wisconsin and some of the strategies being used to reduce the infant mortality rate. Coming up, maybe you're still thinking about whether or not your Thanksgiving dinner requires a turkey. Well, for vegan and vegetarian eaters, this Thanksgiving might require asking a lot of questions and thinking beyond that turkey as the star of the show. We'll hear from the guy who wrote the manual on vegan life about navigating holiday dinners, among other things. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What do the Magic 8 Ball, Uno, and Pinball have in common? They're the latest inductees into the National Toy Hall of Fame. Coming up, we'll talk about what makes a toy or game a classic. First, while the rest of us might be looking forward to sampling all the different dishes on the Thanksgiving table, others might be stressing about which ones they can eat. The holiday time for vegans and vegetarians might require a little bit more patience and some creativity. Our next guest has written the book on all aspects of vegan living, from dating to fitness and strength training and even navigating holiday dinners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're vegan yourself, how do you navigate the holiday meal? Do you get a lot of pushback from family and friends, or do you find family members trying new foods because of your diet? Call 800-642-1234. Bill Muir served in Afghanistan as a combat medic, is now a registered nurse, and he's been a vegan since 1992. He calls himself Sergeant Vegan, and he's the author of the new book, Vegan Strong, The Ultimate Field Manual for a Plant-Fueled Life. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been a vegan, as we said, since 92. You joined the military after September 11th. I can't imagine the military is a real vegan-friendly food environment. Am I right?
No, it is not. You're correct. But while I served, they actually had a vegan MRE, the number 12 bean burrito. So it was slightly easier than you might expect, but pretty similarly difficult.
How many of those did you end up eating, do you reckon?
I actually kept the running tally, 2,500. I'm making that number up, but a lot.
Now, a lot of people might look at a vegan diet and think, okay, that's fine if you want to do it, but if you are, living an active lifestyle, working out, strength training, that sort of thing, you're missing out on some key stuff. You don't buy that at all.
Negative. One of the strongest human beings on the planet, Patrick Boumian, won Germany's Strongest Man in 2012. It's hard to get stronger than that. I mean, strongest in a whole country. So, yeah, and nowadays there's lots of vegan bodybuilders, guys that lift weights such as myself, and females, people that run. There's vegan Olympians. The future is not just vegan, the present is vegan.
And what started out more than 25 years ago in being a vegan and then motivated you to stay one till now?
Yes, sir. I went vegan for the animals as a freshman in college. And just solely for that, I thought it was horrible that we were mistreating animals. And I got into it actually by accident. I gave up meat for Lent in 1992, and it stuck. People thought that I was going to die. People actually told me, nice knowing you. And I just did it because I wanted to do something different, and I cared about the animals. And instead of getting unhealthy and dying like they predicted, I actually felt healthier. I started working out even more, and here I am today.
For someone thinking of giving this a try, what's your advice as far as like thinking ahead and cooking and shopping?
I would say it's not nearly as difficult as you might think. This is not 1995 or 1980 or 1970. This is 2018. There's vegan options everywhere at almost every supermarket that I've ever been to, at least in the last 5 years. So you're not really going to be giving up anything anymore. And no matter who you are or what you're doing, eating more vegetables is always going to be a good plan. So while I can find a vegan version of almost anything, any kind of ice cream, whipped cream, you name it nowadays, even meringue, they have a vegan meringue, I would say concentrate on eating the vegetables and not just the processed foods.
Talking to Bill Muir, a.k.a. Sergeant Vegan. His new book is called Vegan Strong. Now, it is a holiday week, Thanksgiving coming up. Take us through what we might do if someone's a vegan. They're not the host. They're going to somebody else's Thanksgiving to make sure they got something to eat.
So I think it's always important, no matter what you're doing, whether you're going to go on a mission like the missions I went on in Afghanistan, or you're just going to be going to your folks' house or a relative, to have a plan and to come up with it not the night before or an hour before, but maybe a couple days before, even a week before. So calling the host saying, hey, so I'm vegan. Maybe this is a new vegan that we're talking about. So they haven't had that conversation and said, hey, this is what I'm doing lately. So instead of seeing this as a time that you're going to be putting the host out, having that conversation ahead of time saying, hey, I'm going to be bringing my main course, so they don't have to worry about that. And then say, hey, could I bring Earth Balance so we could make the vegetables in Earth Balance instead of butter? And have that option of a side. Also, maybe think about the dessert. You could bring a vegan dessert like vegan apple pie, and who's going to know the difference? Really nobody. Or you could bring a vegan cheesecake, and those are delicious as well. And there's almost anything you could think of as a dessert. So having that conversation, coming up with a plan, and then executing it.
Right, and you don't want to be the like surly guest who's having confrontations about meals, but you also don't want to compromise and say, okay, just this once, I'm going to give in and eat the dairy and the meat.
Exactly. Once you compromise, especially something like this, it's not a good thing. And whether it's, I would like to definitely mention this, whether it's food politics or political politics, Thanksgiving, Christmas, all these holidays are family time, and that's for everybody. So you could kind of, you don't need to argue with your grandma such and such over the what's going on with turkeys or global warming. You could just let that go, and you know, you eat your food, they eat their food, and you share that common ground. Now, I mean, if somebody asks, hey, why are you vegan? You could say, oh, I'm vegan for the animals, and or here are some quick stats on global warming or pollution or whatever. But I would don't ruin the holiday over it. I think that live and let live mentality is still very important even in 2018.
We've got a caller. Lou is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hi.
Hey, good evening, guys. I just want to say this is awesome. Thank you so much for putting this book out. And there's so much support out there for those of us who are vegetarian and are sliding into the vegan realm. I can feel it. I'm doing my research. 54 years old, I turned a vegetarian in 2015 when I saw the different documentaries and felt that I'm not important enough for animals to go through the personal hell they go through for each day. Just to feed us, and that's where I drew the line and quit cold turkey for the most part. So I'm doing my research and will be vegan most likely very, 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 very soon. But I will check out your book, and I appreciate all the information and support that you have, and yay, let's go vegan.
Yay, I love it. Vegan Strong all day long, and Vegan Strong is available on Amazon if anyone's interested. And yeah, definitely congratulations on making the switch toward vegetarians, and double congratulations on the move toward vegan. That's super awesome.
Lou, thanks a lot for calling in. And now, whether we're talking a special holiday meal or just, you know, a nice meal at home, Bill, what are a couple of your favorite go-to vegan dishes?
So I am an RN and I work crazy hours, and I don't have a lot of time for meal prep often. So hey, when I went vegetarian and then vegan, pasta was a thing because it's super easy, and pasta is still something I eat a bunch of. And you can make it a little bit more exciting than just boiling some noodles, throwing some spaghetti sauce in, done. Sauteing garlic and onion before you go, throwing in some tofurkey Italian sausage with it. You can have definitely a delicious dish. Also, Trader Joe's makes a vegan pie crust, pizza crust.
Oh.
And you could have a delicious homemade vegan pizza, especially if you add diet cheese, so you got some cheese on top. In, I'd say I could make it, I could probably put one together in about 5 minutes, 14-minute bake time, it's out in the out of the oven, so 25 minutes done.
And when you're together with non-vegetarians or non-vegans, do they try the stuff you bring special, say, to a Thanksgiving meal?
They do. They do. People like vegan food because the fact of the matter is most people are at least 80% vegan no matter what they say. People are not going to turn up their nose at a salad in 2018. Now they're going to want probably a burger with it as well. But nowadays we have Beyond Burger and Possible Burger, and these are almost exactly the same as meat, and people often like them better. The tides have definitely changed, and it's a wonderfully delicious tide that's coming in.
Does it feel, and you were touching on this earlier, is it just a lot easier to be a vegan in 2018 than when you first started?
It's night and day different. It's not just the food options, which are wonderful. I mean, there was a health food store in the little town that I grew up in that I would have to go to, especially if I want to get tofu, and that was the tofurkey or Gardein of that time. But the public perception of what a vegan is, it has definitely changed. Now, in the military, yeah, I still got some good-natured ribbing, but the military is a place where people will make fun of anything that kind of sticks out, and it's kind of okay, actually. I mean, that's how people often interact. You stay on your ground, you are who you are, and that's that.
We'll leave it there, Bill. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Bill Muir. He's a veteran, a registered nurse. He's been a vegan since 1992, writing as Sergeant Vegan. His new book is Vegan Strong, the ultimate field manual for a plant-fueled life. You can find out more about him and the book at sgtvegan.com, short for sergeantvegan.com. Coming up, the WPR Magic 8 Ball says the outlook is good for our conversation about classic toys. We'll meet the latest inductees into the National Toy Hall of Fame. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, John Munson's guest shares lessons on how to be more patient. Tomorrow? I can't wait that long. I want to know now. But we all have to wait until tomorrow morning at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, when you were a kid and wanted to know what the future held, did you ever consult a magic 8 ball? You ask a yes or no question, give the liquid-filled ball a shake, and read the answer that displays on it, like Bart Simpson and Milhouse did on a school bus.
Well, I passed my English test. Outlook not so good. Wow, it does work.
Let me try. Will I get beat up today? All signs point to yes.
That ball knows everything.
The Magic 8 Ball was introduced in 1946. Now, 72 years later, it finds itself in the National Toy Hall of Fame, alongside the other inductees this year, pinball and the card game Uno. Chris Bench is the chief curator of the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, which is home to the National Toy Hall of Fame. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Great to be with you.
Well, what is the criteria for getting into the Toy Hall of Fame, Chris?
Well, you've got to be a toy that's old enough. It's got to have longevity, in our terms, probably 20 years on the market, so kids and their parents could both have grown up playing with the same item. And then these are all toys you'd recognize. We call them icons, and they're ones that even if you didn't have a radio flyer wagon or a hula hoop or a teddy bear, you absolutely know them at first glance. And finally, these are toys with great play value, ones that, in our terms, encourage learning, creativity, discovery, socialization.
And talk about the definition of toy, because there are things we might think of as toys. There are also games and just kind of things that we play with.
Toy, in terms of the National Toy Hall of Fame, is a very spacious terminology, as you've undoubtedly concluded accurately. It's much catchier to call it the National Toy Hall of Fame than the National Hall of Fame for things that people play with, which
fair.
Is kind of a mouthful. So games, dolls, things that are even not officially a toy. In 2005, we inducted the cardboard box into the Hall of Fame, for example.
And how many toys are now in the Hall of Fame?
A lucky 68 have made it into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about how each year the consideration works when you're figuring out which toys make it in.
It's a difficult process, but we hear from people all over the country. This year we heard from more than 2,000 people who proposed 400 different toys for the Hall of Fame. We looked at all of those, sifted them against our three big criteria, age, identifiability, and play value, and came up with 12 finalists that we then sent out to our National Selection Advisory Committee. That's a group of about 24 people, experts in child development, history, the background of the toy industry, and they're kind of the academy in our own little Academy Awards.
Talking to Chris Bench from the National Toy Hall of Fame, looking at the new inductees into the Toy Hall of Fame and talk about what makes a toy a classic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your all-time favorite toy? What memories do you have? Why is it so awesome? Let's look at these new inductees. Chris, we started off talking about the Magic 8 Ball with that Simpsons clip there. You could still buy these, right?
You can, and they come in all sorts of variations. I was just looking at a Muppets Magic 8 Ball. There are, of course, Simpsons Magic 8 Balls in honor of Bart and Milhouse there. They are so current, right up to the present moment, even though, as you say, they've been around for more than 72 years.
And it's almost a catchphrase, for me anyway, reply hazy, ask again later. That was the great writing of the Magic 8 Ball, I think.
That was, and I think the folks who made the Magic 8 Ball were brilliant in their insight into human psychology. Half the answers on that 20-sided figure inside the ball are positive, a quarter are those in-between answers, and only a quarter are no's.
I didn't know it broke down that way. So you're mostly going to get positive stuff.
That's right. So if you're at your slumber party and you say, will Bobby ask me out to the prom this year, the answer is going to be the one you really hope for, which is absolutely yes.
Whether or not Bobby's really going to do that. Now let's move on to the pinball machine. Pinball has a longer history than I usually think it does when I was reading up from your website.
That's right. It even stretches back in its basic forms into the 19th century. A game called Bagatelle was basically a ball following by gravity through a pattern of pins, a lot more like Japanese pachinko than the kind of game we think of today. And pinball on the four legs with the glass top, that's been part of American culture since the 1930s.
And it's big again. There's a kind of a pinball revival going on. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's huge today. There are competitive pinball championships. It seems like every time I turn around, there's a new barcade coming up that has games and a chance to drink while you play and to keep on dropping those quarters.
Is there a thought that you might actually honor a specific pinball machine? I remember the Evel Knievel machine when I was a kid. I played it a lot. I was never any good at it. Or are we just going to stick with the generic pinball category?
Well, this year it's the category pinball. Maybe there will be one that is so iconic. The trouble is that so many of those are not on the market for very long. There's about a 7-year lifespan at most for pinball titles, and then they get retired and there's a fresh game out there at your favorite laundromat or bar or other emporium.
I am seeing retro games showing up more and more, like Pinbot and some others that I played, late 80s, early 90s. I am seeing restored ones turn up in, you know, bars and here and there. Is that a trend we're going to see more of?
I think it is, and I think in our day of living our lives on screens, it's so engaging for people to have an analog, three-dimensional way to play in what's mostly a social environment, even if a few people have them in their basements. We mostly play in somewhere that other people are playing alongside us.
And then finally, Uno was the third new inductee, and it joins a number of other games in the Toy Hall of Fame. Why did Uno make it in this year?
You know, Il Uno is perfect for maybe even this week for Thanksgiving. It is perfect for multi-generational gatherings because it's got all the instructions are right there on the cards. And it's one of the few card games that kids can compete with grown-ups on a level playing field and maybe even actually win the game.
We're talking about classic toys, including the 2018 inductees to the National Toy Hall of Fame, the Magic 8-Ball, Pinball, and Uno. Chris Bench is with us, chief curator of the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, home to the Toy Hall of Fame. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you now or did you ever have a Magic 8-Ball? Are you a pinball fan? Do you play Uno? Will you be playing it Thursday with family? Do you have memories about those? And what is your most memorable toy or game? What memories do you attach to it? What toys do you think belong in the Toy Hall of Fame? There's a good chance they're already in there, 68 of them already. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear about your favorite toy, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about this year's inductees into the National Toy Hall of Fame, the Magic 8-Ball, Uno, pinball machines. Chris Bench is with us, chief curator of the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. That's home to the National Toy Hall of Fame. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is in your personal Toy Hall of Fame? A toy, a game, a pinball machine, a video game? What toy did you enjoy growing up with? Maybe handing on to a next generation. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Max is with us in Duluth. Max, hi there.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I just want to talk about pinball. I was excited to hear that it's making a comeback, and I've actually noticed it. I grew up, I'm a child of the 90s, and I remember my grandparents' pizza place, they had the old taxi pinball machine.
Oh, yeah.
That had Pinbot and Santa and Dracula. Oh, I'd forgotten about it, and down in the cities, they have a pinball bar that I ran into called Tilt, and it was the coolest thing to see that, and that it's making this resurgence. They're making these pinball machines, bringing them back to life with LEDs, and a new generation is learning to enjoy them, and I'm stoked on it.
Max, were you any good at, like, Taxi or the other machines? Because I played them a lot. I was terrible.
Yeah, so when I was a kid, I remember losing to my brother a lot. He's older, of course, and so that's a fond memory. But I actually whooped him when we were down there last, so it was pretty exciting.
Nice. Max, thanks a lot for the call. Chris, with what we're talking pinball or Lincoln Logs or whatever, people have their family stories about these toys.
That's what we value as much as the items in the museum's collection. Those memories, those special occasions, those dramatic losses or fabulous wins, we love hearing those kinds of stories and capturing them as part of the history of play.
Max, thanks for calling. Glad you beat your brother. We'll go next to Tom in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Magic 8-Ball. I had two older sisters. I was the only boy. I wanted to break that open, get that little thing out. Never did. It was pretty solid game. But the gift I got, I wasn't planning, I wasn't expecting this, didn't even know about it. I got it for Christmas. It was called Photo Electric Football. What it was a box with a light bulb inside of it. And you'd get these cards with the plays on them and put it on the screen, and then the other person would put their card over it, and that would be the defense, and it would show you how far you went, and then until it ran across another player. And I didn't know how to play it, and I played it wrong for a long time. And then a couple of years, we finally figured it out, and it was a lot of fun.
Tom, thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, those Magic 8-Balls. I don't know if you wanted to break those open. I don't know what the liquid was. But have you heard of that photoelectric football? Chris, that's one I haven't encountered.
You know, that's incredible. We just got one last week from the 1930s.
Wow.
And it is a competitor for the other football game lots of us think of, Tudor Electric Football, with that vibrating board.
Tom, thanks a lot for calling in. And he mentioned something that I love. He thinks he played it wrong for the first couple of years. I think that's sometimes the mark of a good toy. You can play it in ways maybe it wasn't intended for, and it's still a lot of fun.
That's right. When we inducted the Easy Bake Oven, the memories that we heard about were not exclusively about delicious baked goods. They were also about the smell of molten plastic as kids shoved little green army men inside them.
No. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Mark is with us now in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious, whatever happened to marbles or fighting cops? Pretty much the same principle. You had your ring. You would shoot your marble, try to knock somebody else's out. Same with the tops.
Gotcha. Marbles and the fighting tops, Chris.
You know, marbles are in the National Toy Hall of Fame. They got in a long time ago in 1998, but tops are not yet in the Hall of Fame, and I think they would be a fantastic addition. They've been around for centuries.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Tim is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi there, Tim.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us?
I was just going to call about the pinball. I think they've done a pretty good job at bringing pinball machines into the modern century. One of your previous callers had mentioned that he's seen them with LED displays. And there's an event in Milwaukee, the Midwest Gaming Classic, where you can see a lot of these. And they have them where, you know how the old pinball machines, you'd have to get goals, you know, to get certain things unlocked and bonus points. Now they have them where the LED display clearly visualizes that. You're almost playing two games at once, kind of, where it'll break on the bottom screen, or on the bottom, and go to the top screen, and then you're doing stuff up there. It's pretty exciting.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, Chris, I could see, I don't know, I have mixed feelings sometimes. Like, I want, more just the mechanical part of it, but those electronic bells and whistles can be kind of cool, too.
They can, and I have to say I love the multi-layered pinball games that have multiple layers and ramps and various sorts of devices on the play field that really make it complicated and exciting.
Tim, thanks for the call. Do you have a lot of exhibits of pinball machines, a lot of actual machines at the Hall of Fame?
We do. In fact, we've got an entire exhibit called Pinball Playfields that is exclusively pinball games. And one of the things I've learned is how much heat pinball and other arcade machines put off, or maybe it's just the people sweating over the games.
All right, we'll go to Tom now in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What toy did you want to bring up?
Wanted to find out if the Spirograph has made it in.
Oh, were you a fan of the Spirograph in your youth or more recently, Tom?
Oh, absolutely. I love the Spirograph, and I did see a friend of my daughter's had a new one, so I was surprised to see that it was still around.
Oh, I didn't know they were still doing them. Okay, Chris, Spirograph, Hall of Fame?
It is not yet in. It has been a finalist, and I'm pleased to say that the folks who are currently producing Spirograph tried to bribe me this year with cookies decorated with icing with Spirograph designs on them. They were really impressive, and Spirograph is delicious as well as fun to play with.
Oh, so this is like the Oscars where they're putting out swag bags and stuff and trying to win the voters over.
I am willing to be more, have more people try.
Tom, thanks for the call. David is with us in Shawano. David, hi.
Yes, hi. You're talking about pinball machines, and I did play them. I'm a child of the 60s and 70s. But when I got out of the service, I worked for a company for over 20 years, and we made the, off and on, we made the pinball tops, the plywood top where the ball rolls on. And we made them for a while, and they were a big hot item. Then they went away for a while because all the electronic stuff came out. But then in about, must have been like the 90s or something, then it came back as, people were getting back into the retro. So that was, that's what I did.
All right, Dave, well, you brought a lot of joy into the world. Thanks for that call. Chris, we just have a minute or so left. What up-and-coming toys do you have your eyes on maybe for future inductees?
Well, my personal one that I think has been sadly overlooked are Matchbox toy cars. They were one of my favorites growing up, and I am worried that Hot Wheels got into the Hall of Fame first, even though Matchbox was there long before them.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for joining us. Always a lot of fun.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
That's Chris Bench, chief curator of the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. They house the National Toy Hall of Fame. We talked to them about, among other things, this year's new inductees, the Magic 8 Ball, Uno, and Pinball. Still time for you to share your favorite toys with us. Tell us about them. You can bring them in and share them with us, too, if you want. I won't say no. But you can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. When school districts across the country responded to a survey about what kind of technology purchases they were planning on making this year, 90% said they were looking for technology to support what's called personalized learning. As Kyla Calvert-Mason reports, it's an approach more and more schools are using here in Wisconsin.
There's a lot going on in Lissa Lauerdorf's third and fourth grade math class at Johnson Creek Elementary School. Some students are learning about fractions.
Wait, so we have a number line, we have a set. What's another way to represent fractions?
Another group is figuring out factors.
How can multiplication help you with factors?
Students rotate between working with Lauerdorf and practicing these new skills in small groups. And when they're done with that, they move independently to working on skills they're learning at their own pace. Derek Hernandez is looking at the online platform Johnson Creek uses to track students' progress on the skills laid out in the state's grade level standards.
There's pie charts, and once one is all blue, it means I'm proficient and I don't need to work on that level anymore.
To keep turning those pie charts blue, Hernandez picks another skill. He'll watch videos and do practice problems until he's confident enough to share his work with Lauerdorf. She'll either sign off on the skill as completed or send him back for more practice. This is one way to do personalized learning, but it's not the only one. Richard Halverson researches technology and education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says even advocates don't always agree on what the term means.
Some people think it's the shape of the learning environment. Some people think it's the use of computer adaptive learning tools. Some people think it's interest-driven learning.
He and his grad students have identified common threads they see in schools that use the ideas with success.
They turn around their whole classroom to try to figure out what do kids need and what do they want to learn, and then they organize instruction around that.
About 30 miles from Johnson Creek, another school built around personalized learning takes an approach where students spend less time in what looks like traditional classes and classrooms. On a day early in the school year, some students are working in pairs and larger groups at the Waukesha STEM Academy. They're in the school's toy and game design workshop. Every year, students at the middle school campus learn about design, marketing, and research in the semester-long workshop. Elizabeth Schulte is working alone. She's trying to decide between creating a video game based on the flora and fauna of a local nature preserve or a Legos-like city designing toy.
Well, I'm definitely going to try the Fox River one first, but if I can't figure out how to do the programming, then I'm going to have to do the city build one because we only have a limited amount of time and I have to figure out which one would be the wiser decision.
Managing and planning her time is part of what she's learning. Amy Bigelow has a daughter at the STEM Academy. She says the way the school pairs personalization with projects like this has turned around how she feels about school. Bigelow remembers afternoons during elementary school.
And she would come home after school just really in a funk every day.
But that's changed.
She came home the first week and she said, Mom, I didn't realize I'm learning, but it doesn't feel like I'm learning.
Enthusiasm and student independence are the kinds of outcomes personalized learning advocates tout. But researchers haven't found that it leads to significant improvements in test scores. Halverson says that could be because personalized learning is an effort to get away from teaching that's focused on standardized tests.
Do we want young people who take control of their own learning and can set their own path and articulate their own goals? Do we want kids who master standards and are proficient at standardized-based content? Do we want both?
He says those are the questions education policymakers are grappling with. Whether more schools embrace personalized learning could depend on their answers. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, cities around the country offered up big money to win Amazon's second headquarters. Our guest says next time around, cities should just say no to corporate incentives. Plus, talking to people across the political landscape, our guest says it's worth the effort. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 7:30, a growing number of Americans identify as biracial or multiracial. A Wisconsin expert on diversity joins the show with a look at biracial identity and what it means in American culture today. That's tomorrow after 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and then Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, a bill that would remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list has passed the U.S. House. It has a Wisconsin sponsor in the House. We'll look at its prospects in the Senate and what would change if it ultimately passed both chambers of the legislature and got signed into law by the president. You can weigh in on that and any other issue you hear us talk about here on the Ideas Network. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can email ideas@WPR.org. And of course, we've got lots of conversations going over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And heck, check out WPR.org and WPR.org/Food Friday for some last minute holiday cooking suggestions as well. Lots of ways to be in touch with us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.